My name's Nancy Casey. I'm your host today for Recovery Radio, and I'm excited to have Denise Miller in the studio with us. And Denise is going to talk about some of her experiences in life and with the Latah County Drug Court. So stay tuned. We got that coming up. I'm so happy to have Denise here in the studio. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you, Nancy. And I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming and being willing to kind of talk about your experiences and inform us all.
Thank you. Happy to.
So I was introduced to Denise because she had experience with the Idaho Drug Court. So I'm going to begin with just a brief explanation of what the drug court is, if you're not familiar with it. And then we'll hear more from Denise than from me after that. So the Idaho Drug Court Act was enacted by the legislature in 2001, and it established drug courts in the district courts of the state of Idaho. The drug court is a diversionary court, which means it diverts people from the traditional criminal justice system, and the court is intended to deal with not just the behavior or the offense that put the person in contact with the criminal justice system, but to deal with the underlying problems. Many participants have already been in prison or are facing prison or probation, and defendants are typically referred by an attorney or a probation officer. People in the program have often been caught in possession of drugs or charged with DUI or theft. If a person is accepted into the drug court, they enter into a contract and begin working with a team that includes the judge, a court coordinator, a treatment provider, law enforcement, defense attorneys, and probation or parole officers. Teams meet weekly to discuss each person, and then each person comes to court for a weekly hearing. Under the contract, the person agrees to the participants are prohibited from consuming alcohol or drugs. They're required to attend treatment 3 to 4 times a week and to attend the weekly court hearing. They have to check in every morning for urine samples and work at least 32 hours a week or complete volunteer hours. The average length of the program for a person who participates is 18 to 24 months. And if a person is successful, charges are either dismissed or the offender is released from probation. So that's kind of the overview of the drug court, which exists here in Latah County, and it's a good thing.
It is a good thing, absolutely.
So I thought we would start maybe in the middle of your story,
sure,
and work our way out. So what did it feel like to get arrested?
Oh, I was so scared.
Uh-huh.
So scared. I was, I had never been to jail before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had briefly been to jail, technically, a little bit before that happened, but I knew I was in pretty big trouble when I was arrested this mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. that time.
Yeah, how did it go down?
I was actually, we were homeless, and my husband and I and my two children were staying at a friend's house,
mm-hmm.
and literally, like, this task force came mm-hmm. and arrested me and mm-hmm. one other person.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, yeah, it was mm-hmm. pretty overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
I was upset to leave my family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Looking back on it now, while I was in the program, at a certain point, I realized that my view became that it was like the magical chariot came mm-hmm. and rescued me
mm-hmm.
and gave me my life back. That was the start for me to get better.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
really, it was a blessing.
Mm-hmm. A bizarre blessing.
Mm-hmm.
So you got yourself into a space where you could get arrested, and that's not something you like wake up one morning and decide to do. It's rather just like recovery. It's a process.
Yes.
So there's a point in this process where the substances you're abusing are working together with your tricky brain and convincing you that what you got going on here is working. Can Can you describe what your life was like when you were under the illusion that everything was working, like how you schemed and navigated to keep the surface of the water supposedly level?
Yeah, that's a big question, but I'm going to try to work through it. I remember at times feeling like there would be no way that I could exist without them, because how would I even be able to get up in the morning? Mm-hmm. Because at a certain point into my use, that was the first thing I did in the morning, basically.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk about what substances you were
sure.
using?
Yeah. So I started off in my late 20s, so like 28-ish, and you know, just smoked weed.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't really a big thing for me. It didn't really, you know, make a big deal. But I winded up injuring my back with work, and I got a prescription for pain medicines.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, I winded up finding someone to purchase them from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that for
so
the
there
whole
was
duration.
There was a transition somehow between mm-hmm. back pain and self-medication.
Yes.
Can you describe that? I guess I'm asking
right.
you that because people tumble down this slope mm-hmm. without a sense that they're mm-hmm. tumbling down a slope. And I wonder if looking back, you can describe it in slow motion.
I think so. So it helped me get through the pain that I was experiencing, and it gave me energy. It was like the quick fix.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of adjusting my job and maybe doing something different and, mm-hmm. and being willing to change my mm-hmm. life, I took the easy way.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, I felt I needed to have those things in my life, that it was absolutely necessary
mm-hmm.
every day
mm-hmm.
to have these things mm-hmm. to be able to exist.
And it probably just wasn't a delusionary idea, because without them, how did you feel?
Oh, I was sick.
Uh-huh. Sick mm-hmm. like how?
Sick as in like the flu kind of sick.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, this wasn't right in the beginning, but uh-huh. as time went on, it very, very sick,
mm-hmm.
like the flu, and
mm-hmm.
then no energy. And then mentally, my mind, you know, had made itself up to be that it was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so mm-hmm. there was a lot of looking back at it, just false beliefs with it.
Mm-hmm. So you had two kids living with you at the time, and your kids are...
Well, fresh? Actually, at that time when mm-hmm. I started, I have two adult children.
Mm-hmm.
So this would have been when my son Christopher, who would have been like seven... Well, no, he was younger. He was only a few years old. So he'd been about three or four
mm-hmm.
when I very first started. And then my oldest daughter lived with my mother. And so my two younger kids, this is, mm-hmm. that was later that mm-hmm. I had them.
Mm-hmm. So you had one child
mm-hmm.
living
son.
With you. Were you able to sort of like function
mm-hmm.
as a mother and keep that ship afloat? So, you know, you've got a child that's got to get up in the morning mm-hmm. and be fed and get off to school and
yes.
look okay and seem okay and...
In so, the beginning,
uh-huh,
yes.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't until I started, you know, using cocaine, methamphetamines, and getting into using intravenously that mm-hmm. things started to get super chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
Although I will say for the first handful of years that because getting pain meds became a priority,
mm-hmm.
there was some selfishness definitely going on with me and my choices
mm-hmm.
that were affecting my family.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. What I did with my time and my money.
Uh-huh. Can you give a specific example?
Well, something? I think that there's a certain thinking when you put a substance before everything else,
mm-hmm.
other things become not as important. And I just see that now that I put different, you know, family, God, and things like that as priorities, things work out well. But before, when I was putting drugs and all of that first, it just wasn't healthy choices that,
mm-hmm.
that affected everyone around me. I'm trying to think of good examples. You know, at certain points, it led to, you know, paying bills late and,
mm-hmm.
you know, going into debt.
Mm-hmm.
And about halfway through my 30s, we lost our home that we
mm-hmm.
were buying.
Mm-hmm.
So then that, you know, that put us out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that affected my son. He winded up his senior year living with a friend.
Mm-hmm. And so was your husband using too?
He was.
Okay. So mm-hmm. so you were a team.
Yes.
In that sense.
In that sense, yes.
Yeah. So that you could, it sort of works out to reinforce one another's denial.
It does, yeah. Because there's really no one there to encourage much different. Mm-hmm. I mean, my mother tried for several years to be helpful, and then she finally realized there was nothing much she could do, mm-hmm. and she just had to let go, uh-huh. and, you know, step back.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a lot to take in.
It is, because it went on for a long time.
Yeah. Let's stop and take a break. Let's just take a little musical break here. Should we play Run with let's play this and then, or do you want to introduce it?
So mm-hmm. I think this is fitting because I remember watching the video and the lady just isn't paying attention to how God wants to be in her life and help her. And I can relate to it. I can relate to listening to this before when I was using and not understanding what it meant. And I understand what it means now. And I'm happy that I do.
Here it is, Run by Cutlass.
Why do you run? Why do you hide? Oh, don't you know I just want to be with you. To be with you. Looking down from above, as you watch TV, wondering why, oh, you're ignoring me. Do you remember when I came to you, and you loved me, and I'm weak. Be with you. Hey, why do you run?
So one of the things that we talked about is that from the perspective that you're in now, looking back on those hard times, it's almost like sort of scratching your head, trying to know if it's like your actual life or some book that you read that you really remember a little bit. But one thing that is clear that I thought maybe we could just like touch on briefly before we go into some of your experiences after that mm-hmm. moment of arrest, that it's not just a simple matter of getting some kind of psychological or physical relief from one substance and doing that substance more and more. But for you, it was one substance leading to another mm-hmm. and another and another, and each one eroding more of your ability to like care for yourself
mm-hmm. absolutely,
and recognize that you were in trouble. Can you kind of describe how that trajectory went for you? I'm doing the mm-hmm. motion now, and then when you were talking about early, you do that motion with your hand where right. it goes up and up and up, and then mm-hmm. it goes like
right
down,
the crash and burn kind of thing. So so basically just tried smoking weed mm-hmm. and then moved on to using like hydros and those kinds of things mm-hmm. and then
that was
tried
from the back injury mm-hmm. yeah.
yep. And then tried cocaine for a little mm-hmm. while.
So was it so the back injury kind of really opened the door into
it? Kind of did.
Like there's lots of things you can get.
Yeah, it really did, and that's why it's so important when I look back at that to remember when I'm facing pain or a challenge, there's more than just one or two options, and mm-hmm. if it's a bad choice, if it's dishonest or unhealthy, there has to be another way. Mm-hmm. I have to change. I have mm-hmm. to look and get help and reach out. Mm-hmm. That. Those choices to make bad choices, basically, they're not okay. They just mm-hmm. can't do that. But
you were mm-hmm. kind of in the hydrocodone family,
mm-hmm. yes,
and was doing certain things for you that mm-hmm. seemed to be good. Mm-hmm. And then how did it escalate?
So then it just escalated to cocaine, just being out at a party mm-hmm. and trying it. Mm-hmm. And again, it seems so weird because in my childhood, in my high school years and things like that, I would have never, ever made that choice. Mm-hmm. It's so strange. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have been the first one to walk out of that party. I was always the first one to be the designated driver. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there was just different things going on in my life that had never been dealt with. Mm-hmm. And here I was making these choices because I was trying to run away from basically thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And these things were making me feel good. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how to deal with things that were going on in my life.
Mm-hmm. And then cocaine wasn't enough, or something better presented itself?
Basically, something better presented itself. Yeah, and that was methamphetamines. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, it became using intravenously with pain meds and methamphetamines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, it's like there's a joy of cooking aspect to all of this. Mm. How did you become educated? Try this, and here's the rituals around this, and what's that part of the process like?
So I actually did talk to the people that I was getting these substances from. Mm-hmm. I would like look things up because I sounds strange to say, but I was concerned about how mm-hmm. I was doing these things. Mm-hmm. It does. It sounds so strange to say,
consumer.
But I was trying to be an informed user. Uh-huh. I really was. Uh-huh. I wasn't trying to kill myself with it. Uh-huh. You know, I was trying to benefit from, you know, the drugs and things like that. But I was trying to do them the correct way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I really would look things up mm-hmm. and read about them and stuff and make sure what I was doing or what I was mixing.
Mm-hmm. And then, no matter how much stuff you look up, you don't quite exactly find the recipe for mm-hmm. peace and contentment down this path. Mm-hmm. You got arrested. Kaboom. Mm-hmm. How did you end up in the drug court? I guess that's, how was that presented?
So earlier that year, it would have been probably 2013, in the spring, I had gotten in trouble, had gotten pulled over, and I had gotten a possession charge that was just kind of kind of just hanging out, waiting to be taken care of. And then finally, I think that everyone got kind of impatient, you know, the justice system, which was good. And they found me because I had been running for about 5 months. Mm-hmm. And
oh, so like missing court dates and.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Of course, because I was in that crash and burn stage of like, you know, just there was nothing that I was doing really that was being responsible. Mm-hmm. So and I was scared. I hadn't ever really been in trouble before. So. So I had gotten arrested, and while I was in jail, I had heard previously about Weeks in Vitry, and so I was very excited to find mm-hmm. out some information on that. So I wanted help.
So Weeks in Vitry is a mm-hmm. counseling service.
Yes, it
right.
is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're in jail, and Weeks in Vitry pops into your mind. Mm-hmm. So how much freedom do you have in jail to follow up on this idea that this name of this institution or this mm-hmm. service might help you? You know,
so when my public defender came in, we both talked about doing drug court mm-hmm. And about Weeks in Vitry, because I had known somebody that summer that was in that program mm-hmm. And I did want help. I just, before I had been arrested, I couldn't fathom the idea of how I could get help, and I didn't know how to go about all of it, and I was scared. Mm-hmm. And so we got talking about it. She's like, I think that, you know, you would be a good candidate for that. And then Kathy Weeks from Weeks in Vitry and one other person from the drug court team came in and interviewed me mm-hmm. and decided that I would be a good candidate.
Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, I'm getting this like first day of school kind mm-hmm. of little plaid dress kind of feeling about how that used to feel to me, I guess, when I was in grade school and mm-hmm. starting out that September thing. How did first day of school in terms of drug court, new life, how did that feel at the beginning?
I was excited. I was uh-huh. super nervous. Uh-huh. I had no idea at all how this was all gonna like unroll or happen or be, but I was super determined. I mean, I think that everybody that was around me could really tell. I mean, I think that when Kathy came in, when Shauna came in, that they really knew that this was something that I really wanted to do. It was on my heart, and I was going to figure out a way to do it. The alternative to failing drug court would be to go away on a rider and to be taken away from my family, which, you know, rightfully so, would be a good thing, but isn't something that I wanted to have happen. I wanted to succeed. Mm-hmm. I knew that would be, quote, the backup plan. Mm-hmm. I was in Latah County Jail for about 28 days away from my children and my husband. And, you know, that was a lot on all them. And I was now that I was in Latah County Jail, being sober, it was all
was
coming clear.
Withdrawal period? Did you suffer a lot?
I didn't. I woke up the next morning, and it was absolutely amazing. I just remember opening up my eyes and feeling like everything was going to be okay. I literally was like, I really felt like God was there with me. Hmm. And I was just like, okay, we're going to do this, you know? And I felt fine, which is unheard of in my mind, because usually people are there that have been doing the things that I was doing, and they're throwing up. Mm-hmm. Some of them are being hospitalized because they don't have that substance in them anymore. Mm-hmm. And I was okay. Mm-hmm. And I just really took that to heart.
That
it was a sign. Yeah.
If you're going to get a gift, you're going to accept the gift.
Yes.
I want to break here and how about that one? Oh, there it is. I guess we're getting this one whether we want it or not.
I see the city lights all around me. Everyone's obscure. 10 million people, each with their problems. Why should anyone care? As I can see, and fast and lost in this world, lost in a sea of faces. You're my
the greatness of space, yet somehow you still find the time for me. It's then you show me your love in your eyes I can see.
That was Big Daddy Weaver with My Story. So I'm talking today, or we're, it's not here, the second one. Okay. Been talking today with Denise Miller, who has come into the studio with us on Recovery Radio to talk about some of her experiences with the drug court here in Latah County. And the drug court is... it's what's known as a diversionary court in the sense that it diverts people away from the traditional criminal justice system if they have underlying issues and other needs that if they were addressed, then they would be done with the criminal justice system for good. So Denise was telling us how the experience of being arrested and everything that led up to it in retrospect was terrible. But that moment also was an enormous turning point. She saw it as a great opportunity to turn things around and make them different, and was probably kind of walking into this program as a potential star pupil. So then you start jumping through the hoops. There's like a pajillion restrictions on you and all of these things that you have to do. Tell us what some of those were and which ones were like easy and exciting for you and which ones were challenging.
So those were, you have a probation officer that you need to report to weekly. You have UAs that you need to be ready to take every day.
That's a urine analysis.
Yes. You have classes about 4 days a week. Those classes may have changed slightly now as to what they're called, but at the time, they were, oh goodness, now I'm going to space out what they're called. But so you're taking classes that basically are helping you identify what... how you affected people. How did you affect your family? By using yourself, the community, you are owning your crimes and things like that. And you're just, you're taking a real deep look into ownership for what using drugs or alcohol, how it's affected you and how it's affected the people around you.
So you take these classes with how many other people?
So they're like small groups. So they're going to be anywhere probably from six to maybe... oh, I know we squeeze a lot of people in there every now and then, but I'd say 15. So basically they're small groups. It just depends on the attendance at the time. I think that drug court as a whole takes on around 22 people at a time. Yeah. And so you need to be on time to these classes. I mean, it's a really, really big deal if you're late or if you miss anything. If you miss a class, you can go spend a day in jail. If you fail a UA, I mean, these things, they're very strict about. And there's reasons.
So all those old skills of talking yourself through things that don't seem quite right, you don't get to use anymore.
No, you can't use any excuses of, you know, my dog ate my homework or, you know, there was too much traffic, because you have to plan ahead and assume that there's going to be too much traffic. You know, those kinds of things. Yeah, you have to be very responsible. The idea is to get you from living your life where you were being irresponsible back on track to being a good person in society, to having a job, to, you know, being good with your family, so that you can start making better choices. And then in our counseling and stuff like that, we have the opportunity to address, you know, things that are going on, things that have gone on in our lives, to work through those things. At the time when I was in drug court, I had Elizabeth as my counselor, and she was excellent. And, you know, that was just like some kind of me time. And she was just great. I mean, she would tell me, you know, it's okay when things just aren't okay. It's okay. And I mean, still to this day, sometimes I'm just like, well, it's okay when things just aren't okay. I can sit through pain, fear, and not have to go use now. And usually I even talk myself through it and just say, you know, there's really no reason I need to be afraid. There's really not. Time and time again, my beliefs, you know, I believe in God and Jesus, and he has carried me through things, you know, every day. And so I don't need to rely on substances anymore to deal with fear or anger or hurt or resentment.
So your Christian faith is really strong.
It is.
Is that something new?
So I grew up believing in God. My grandma was really a really big part of that for me. After my father passed when I was seven, things were very chaotic, and I'm pretty sure that it's that was my childhood struggle, is my father was murdered when I was seven. And it was really hard for all of us. And my mom was really young too. She was only 31, and we moved around a lot. And I think that when I was in my later 20s and I decided to use, that I was just, I don't know, just at the end of being okay anymore. I think that these things just hadn't been completely dealt with, and that was my way of dealing with it.
I just kind of flashed on this thing that I have heard said, that I just always like turning this idea over in my mind, and it's the notion that a person's, in order for a person's life to change, there might or might not be a change in circumstances, but the largest change is a change in imagination, so that your life changes when who you are in the world and your picture of yourself, the way that you imagine yourself in the world, when that changes, the rest of your life just changes around you. And I've always thought of that like in a really positive sense, like change my imagination of myself and things move forward.
I agree.
Well, I just got struck by, if you were 7 years old and you traumatically lost your dad, how did that change your imagination of yourself in the world, or maybe even establish your imagination of yourself in the world, because you were so small?
It was hard. It was really hard. I mean, I think that all children want to have both parents. Little girls want their daddies. And I had an excellent mother. She's awesome. I couldn't have a better mother. But you just, things are different. You don't have that male perspective growing up. I felt, even though it wasn't, quote, his choice to die, I still felt abandoned. And I still grew up with daddy issues. I did. I really did. I struggled in relationships with men. I struggled in relationships even with females, even with friends. And so I was able to deal with some of those things through my counseling at Weeks in Vitry. And it really made a big change. And then when I started going to Real Life Church a few years ago, again, I got to experience healing again with them. And I guess for me, my faith has to do with it. it just seems like all of my life I've been this person. And I go to church on Sundays, every Sunday, and I listen to Aaron or whoever's speaking that day, and what they say, it's like who I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's a literally who I want to be and things that I believe in already. And there's someone up there telling me that that's a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm so excited.
Mm-hmm.
Like that it's a good thing to love on people and be kind and be forgiving and to let go of resentments and all those things. And the more that I attend, the more I realize that the positive things that they're saying, if I would have been living that way before, I never would have chose to do drugs. Ever. Mm-hmm. I never would have.
Mm-hmm.
If I wasn't dragging around resentment and hurt and things like that, I would have had no reason to honestly stick a needle in my arm
mm-hmm.
to try to make it go away.
Mm-hmm. But the hurt and the resentment that you were, as you say, like dragging around, mm-hmm. I guess I get the impression they were more glommed onto you than, you know, you talk about mm-hmm. making choices
mm-hmm.
that I don't think there was an informed choice in there that says, I will now take hurt and resentment into my life, that mm-hmm. that they hurt and resentment had moved into your life before you even knew right. that space was available for other things.
Right. I think that if I would have had, well, I mean, retrospectively, I think it would have been good to have more community as I was growing up mm-hmm. and to be located and not move so much mm-hmm. so that I could have had ongoing healthy relationships with women in my life and with, you know, some mm-hmm. male friends that could have helped work through these things that would have mm-hmm. built trust with people mm-hmm. and stuff. I definitely do not regret my life or anything mm-hmm. because it's who I am. And I feel like these challenges that have come have brought me to wanting to change.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. like this, the way that I was living, the things that I were doing, it was just awful. It was painful.
Mm-hmm.
That pain causes you to look at things and go, you know, I think I should change.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Mm-hmm. And drugs kept me in an area where I was unable to look at myself and change.
Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing, as you talk about the different things that you did under the guidance of the drug court, they were all, each one that you've talked about is a little bit different. Like there's the classes mm-hmm. that you take with other people where you're kind of opening up a little bit and talking kind of maybe in a bigger scope about the situation that you all are in. And then there is counseling, which is very personal
mm-hmm.
and
it is
all about you. And then there is these cold, hard relationships about being on time and constant mm-hmm. drug testing mm-hmm. and
guidelines.
Yeah. Any other kind of categories of activities that you do?
Well, for me, I winded up leading a relapse prevention class
mm-hmm.
that a gal before me had done, but she had graduated. She kind of passed it along to me. So I was taking on something that was kind of unusual to me, and that was kind of like a leadership kind of position,
mm-hmm.
like where I was, I mean, I wasn't like a teacher there. It wasn't mm-hmm. paid or anything. It was just kind of like how we have NA and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But this was, it kind of had a curriculum behind it. I would pick out things that had to do with staying in recovery, and I would teach them once a week.
Mm-hmm.
So there was my own personal evolving going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I read about when I was looking up the drug court, it says one of kind of the assumptions that's built into the program
mm-hmm.
is that people are going to relapse.
Yes.
Because it just, like, I think it was Judge Stegner told the newspaper that it's just the nature of the situation. So you have to build relapse into mm-hmm. the system. You can't just, like, boot people out and mm-hmm. say, ha. So, can you identify some of the physical or psychological or personal sensations and impressions of what you might call the relapse moment? Like, what, you know, knowing mm-hmm. all of this information about how terrible it was mm-hmm. over there, what is it that pull somebody so hard in those relapse moments?
So I think that there's probably a lot to that question.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this though before I answer that. It's important to make sure that you're aware of where you are. I think that from the minute that I entered into drug court, I tried to make sure that the people, places, and circumstances that I was in or around, mm-hmm. that those were drug free, and that they weren't places that were going to trigger me. Mm-hmm. So in drug court, I watched a lot of other people struggle with relapses, mm-hmm. and I feel like those relapses mostly came from trying to deal emotionally with problems that had been going on, and now they're trying to do it without their coping mechanism that they had before, which was drugs or alcohol. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. People will get emotionally just very upset and make a choice that they can't handle whatever's going on with them at that point. They can't handle the stress, they can't handle the emotions or the situation that's happening around them, and they will go use. Mm-hmm. It's just overwhelming.
So emotional pain, I guess, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, I think emotional pain is definitely a really big one. Or at times, someone will wind up in a situation where they're right in front of them. Mm-hmm. Because as we walk the streets and we're in drug court, that doesn't mean that our old friends won't be like, hey, you want to go get high?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would suspect that there's an enormous amount of tension that suddenly inserts itself in these old relationships.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And because I had a lot of family, it was easier for me to just let it be known that, hey, you know, I'm doing this. Love you guys, but I'm doing this. And so you probably won't see me.
Mm-hmm. Did your husband go through drug court?
He didn't.
At the same time, he didn't?
No, he didn't.
Yeah. And so that was just a challenge that you had to face.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was. It was really hard for our family in certain aspects, you know, with making sure that we were on time. It was a little stressful at times because at the time we were sharing a car. I didn't have my driver's license back because, you know, mm-hmm. along with using drugs, I was very irresponsible and I'd got myself in trouble with that too. So it was a little bit stressful, but he did very well in making sure that I got where I needed to be and taking care of us, you know, mm-hmm. financially and things. It was
mm-hmm.
good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he was using as like you were using together at some point,
right? And we both had to stop,
and you both had to stop.
Yeah.
But only you went through the
through
the drug court.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you have an alcoholic, and then you have what's the word I'm looking for? The one that functions, the one that doesn't. So I was mm-hmm. the alcoholic that doesn't function well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he was, the like high functioning, that's a term that they use.
Yes.
And so, so in a sense, even though it was only you mm-hmm. Jumping through the hoops and doing the classes and all of those things, actually your entire family went to drug court.
Yes, I guess that's what I'm trying to say is that there were, you know, my stuff was also a part of what the family had to go through too, that there were certain things. I mean, when you're on probation, you can't have alcohol in your home, you can't have firearms, you know, your PO can show up and check these things. So that affected my husband. He had to get rid of those types of things. He couldn't drink at home, you mm-hmm. know, and it's mm-hmm. just a part of the rules. We mm-hmm. can disagree with it or say, well, I'm not an alcoholic or he's not an alcoholic, but they're setting up these guidelines. I think with the drinking, because people tend to, when they stop doing drugs, they tend to pick up a different problem
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
we're coping. We're trying mm-hmm. to cope. And so mm-hmm. our coping mechanisms can change from drugs or alcohol into pornography, shopping, gambling,
mm-hmm.
all sorts of things. Eating too much chocolate, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. it just depends, you know? So they're trying to set us up for succeeding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's... let's give you a chance to have a little drink of water.
Thanks.
And
humanity, give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see. Give me your eyes. Lord, give me your eyes so I can see. Did I keep missing? Give me your heart for the broken hearted. Give me your heart, Lord. Give me your eyes. My name is great.
it needs its deep harm. When Satan tempts me to despair and tells me of the guilt within, upward I look and see him there, made on and of my sin. Because of sin, the Savior's wrath,
Denise and I are having way too good of a time. We're both talkity-talkity people, and we could keep this up for another 3 hours. But instead, we've got about 3 minutes left. And there's a few things that you just want to make sure that you get across in this interview. So
yes.
Take it away.
Thank you. So I just wanted to let everyone know that Weeks in Beechery is 118 Washington, and their phone number is 208-882-8514. It's important that everyone know that you can be a self-referring client. You can literally just go in there and ask for help. I just feel like everyone in this town that that has any kind of problem would know that. They take Medicaid, Medicare. They have a sliding scale fee, and pretty much if you can make a payment, you can go. There's also a state-funded program that covers IV users and pregnant women, and also they fund, you know, it just depends. You just need to call, and that number is 208-336-4275, and it's called BPA.
BPA, what does that stand for? Do you know?
You know what? I don't. Tracy told me. And Tracy is the lady at Weeks in Beechery that you would talk to. She's the receptionist, and she's a miracle worker over there.
Mm-hmm. So if you were feeling like desperate, scared, knowing that you have to make a change, half believing that it's not possible, a good place to start, you could like call up Weeks in Beechery and say like, I need help and I'm not sure what.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the person you'd end up talking to would be named Tracy. See? Mm-hmm. Okay. And you could probably even get her name wrong and she wouldn't mind.
She'd still answer the phone.
Okay. And so give us that phone number one more time.
That phone number again is 208-882-8514. 1-4.
Okay. Call that number. And then it's weeks, like days of the weeks. Mm-hmm.
And Vitri.
And Vitri. V I.
Yes. It's V I E T R I, I believe.
Yeah. So if you put weeks and V, Moscow, mm-hmm. Idaho, in a search engine, up it would come.
Yes.
And you could get some help and direction without having to get arrested first.
Yes. Yes. You can be a self-referring patient, just going to get help.
Self-referring. Yes. You don't have to wait until you get a probation officer. Mm-hmm. Denise, I want to thank you so much for coming in today. I hope you can come back. I think we've just like scraped off a little ice from the iceberg, and we got the whole big tip of the iceberg, and we got the down under part of the iceberg. There's just like so much to say, but thanks a lot.
Thank you, Nancy,
for coming in and sharing today.
Thanks.